Morgan Startup Series.
Hi, it's Chris Titley here. As part of the Morgan's Startup Series, I'm joined by Yaz Grigaloonis, founder of the world's biggest garage sale. Yaz, welcome to the studio and thanks for coming in.
Thanks for the invite, Chris. It's great to be here.
Yaz, can you give us a bit of a background on world's biggest garage sale, the concept, how it all began?
Sure. So it was actually quite by accident. In 2013, I was training with a bunch of triathletes. We were all trying to raise money for various causes, and cancer research was really the theme at the time. A lot of us had been touched by cancer ourselves and through our families. So I started to witness what I call donor fatigue. So everyone was swimming or riding or running or baking cupcakes and brownies and selling raffle tickets to try and raise money for charity. And I saw among this group the donor fatigue. You couldn't pull out a $5, a $10 or a $20 note for every single person that you wanted to support. So I said to my husband, Lee, we have a ton of dormant goods around our house. And by dormant goods, I mean that stuff that's in our cupboards and drawers that we were storing away because we weren't giving it to charity. We thought it was a little bit too nice or too good for charity, and we could not honestly be bothered selling it online. And so I thought, let's whip around the house and grab all these dormant goods and have a garage sale. And I thought, we'll raise a couple of grand and it'll be awesome. Like one big event, impact for the charity, and donate all the funds. And what happened is all of my friends and family started to give us their dormant goods. And before too long, our garage, our double garage in Kedron, filled up so much that you could literally not even walk through a tiny little crack to get access to the house. So needless to say, we couldn't have the garage sale at home. And it was on the Friday before the event that had been advertised simply with letterbox drops and a bit of social media that we had to pick up all the stuff, put it in a truck and drive it down to the local hall, which we hired for about $300. And the next morning, the garage sale kicked off at 6 a.m. and we ended up raising $15,000 in a single day.
$15,000 from an idea.
One day, not much planning, hacked together and just executed.
Kedron's biggest garage
sale.
Yeah,
it was huge. And so I thought to myself, and one of my great friends, Alan Kepper, said to me, we were at the checkout together and I literally had thousands of dollars stuffed into my pants. And I thought, oh my gosh, we have created something here. And he said to me, you know what you've done. You're going to have to do this again. And I said, Alan, I'm totally there. And so I literally thought, okay, we'll donate all that money. We made a big impact. We knew that we were having this really good activation of products that would not otherwise been in the marketplace. And seeing people buy some of those products and seeing the way that it touched them and the way that they were really happy to be getting this beautiful quality product because it was stuff that you wouldn't find in op shops. It was nicer. That really motivated me as well. And so the next year I said to the boss, I'm going to take a month off my job, annual leave, and I'm going to do this properly. I'm going to build the world's biggest garage sale. And we knew the hall was not big enough, so we ended up moving into a school. So 2014, we got a key to a local school. The principal basically just said to me, give it back to me the way you found it. And so we used their home ec room to bake cupcakes, to sell on the day. And we effectively went from a couple of trucks of donations to 12 loads of semi-trailer trucks of donations from the community, all given to us so that we could raise funds for the cancer research again. And we ended up having a single one-day sale and selling $60,000 worth of stuff at that event.
So did people drop it off to the school? Is that how it worked initially?
Yeah, so the way we activated the dormant goods was quite interesting. In year one, people kind of came to our house and dropped it off, yep. And we'd send out friends and family in trucks and utes to pick up stuff. The second year, we actually took bookings over the phone using our mobile number because we weren't a business at the time. We were just winging it.
In your annual leave time.
Yeah, in my annual leave. So we would just literally take bookings, write it into a spreadsheet, send out volunteers to go and pick up all this stuff. And it was amazing how the community got behind. What they were passionate about was being able to see their good stuff come into a big event and actually then be purchased by locals in the community, knowing that there was this beautiful harmony of, I'm giving you something and it's not costing me anything to give it to you, but I know you're going to make a donation to a good cause, so I feel like I'm donating even though I might not have the funds to donate. So it's always that, I guess it comes back to, not everybody has cash to give, but everybody has excess stuff. And we were starting to see a big pattern of that over the years that we continued to just run the event and do it all just at a grand scale by taking a month off leave every year.
So 15,000 to 60,000, and then what happens the following year when you say, I want to take leave again?
I took leave again. And this time the school was not big enough, and we knew that, and it was a great experience at the school, but this time we needed a warehouse. So again, I went straight into business development mode and went, all right, well, what do we need? We need a warehouse, we need a big space, we want more stuff again, and we want to raise more money. So we did it one more time as a family, friends and family event, bringing in volunteers of anybody that we could recruit along the way. It was probably this year that we started to get strangers that we didn't know coming from the community to want to volunteer. And we really started to see the essence of this community that we had built. We didn't see it for the first couple of years. And so in year three, we moved into a big warehouse. It was donated to us by Goodman. They had a dormant warehouse, about 4,000 square meters at Cooper's Plains. They weren't using it. We wanted it just for a month so we could again have a space where people could drop off all their stuff. We could send trucks out and have them deliver all the stuff back to this warehouse. And we ended up having almost 5,000 people shop at that event, and we did almost $90,000 in a day. It was amazing.
Yeah, and certainly the business community then coming in, not just the people that want to help, it's now saying, well, we want to get behind you. And you've also had some sponsorship in the past as well.
We have. And look, we could not have done what we did without the support from businesses like Goodman and National Storage. And so we started to go, okay, well, not everybody can get to Cooper's Plains. So how do we get more dormant goods? And how do we make it easy for people to donate to us? And so we would use National Storage locations as drop-off points, have a truck there. People would drop their stuff off, we'd fill a truck, the truck would come back to the warehouse. And we really just mobilized the community to be able to give their stuff instead of it sitting and laying dormant in their homes. We knew that year that we had to make a decision. Are we going to keep doing this and make it bigger and more grand? Or
and remove all holidays from the agenda.
Yeah, so the annual leave was still good. And look, I've worked for a great organisation who were really supportive of it. And we then started to see organisations donating some of their dormant or secondhand products that would otherwise have just sat in their own warehouses, like old laptop computers, just business stuff that lays around in cupboards and drawers. For us, we knew in 2015 that we weren't actually a garage sale, that we were more of a movement around the circular economy, around activating product that charities weren't able to tap into, our op shop charity friends. And we play very nicely in the market, because what we don't sell at our garage sales, we always donate to charity afterwards. And the stuff we get is so great that even at the end of the event, of a one-day event, we're donating high-quality stuff that's already pre-sorted. So we're actually helping the charities and the op shops out along the way as well.
You mentioned that word circular economy. It's a bit of a buzzword floating around. Maybe for the listeners out there, you could potentially sort of describe what exactly it is and how you fit in.
Yeah, sure. So again, it wasn't part of our business plan, and we didn't have a business canvas, and we still weren't a business in 2015. But what we started to see was a pattern of change in not only our behaviour, but the behaviour of our volunteers too. We were all buying less new stuff and starting to activate this circular and secondhand economy. And so typically in this world, we take, make, dispose. We take it from the land, we make something, we use it, we then dispose of it. And we have these beautiful facilities that allow us just to throw stuff into landfill and it disappears from our doors, and we live in a beautiful, clutter-free, rubbish-free world. The problem is the rubbish ends up somewhere. And often it's not actually rubbish. There's a lot of value in this product. And we've seen this shift from take, make, dispose to, okay, let's bring it into the circular economy. What do I have around my house that I'm currently not using? And we were doing this accidentally. People were bringing it to us. And when products would come in, they would fit into multiple categories. They'd either be saleable, recyclable, or at least worth something to somebody else. And we saw this in 2015 when Substation 33 partnered with us, and we were actually collecting all this e-waste product, some of it that didn't work,
phones, computers, stereo,
everything, and yep. the amount
TVs,
of
potentially.
Yeah, gold, copper and precious metals in those products is quite significant
for someone
else. And so instead of just grabbing the broken printer or the phone that doesn't work and it's got a cracked screen and we can't sell it, we actually had these beautiful wheelie bins on site supplied by Substation 33, and we would put all our e-waste into it. And then we were able to activate what they do down in their organisation, which is have the community come through and then harvest and strip out the value of that product, which they're now turning into new products. And that's really when the circular economy comes into its own, is when a product that would otherwise end up in landfill because it's just too hard to repair or pull resources out of, actually stays in the economy and is made into something else, recycled into something else, and not just thrown into a bin.
And I suppose ignorance comes into it a little bit, because you don't know what you don't know until someone, because who would want a broken crack screen TV?
Yeah.
Someone might do. And then as soon as you connect that, then that's a tangible benefit.
It is. And that's when I started to think that we're actually more of a connector. And some people call us middleware or multipliers. We kind of sit in this very interesting middle phase. And so at this time, we needed to make a decision. Are we going to keep growing or not? And we didn't really know, like you said, what we didn't know. And we knew we were doing a lot of good. So we really had to design a business around the stuff that we had done. So we really were reverse engineering our business. We were using Agile. We were capturing data. We didn't really have an ABN, a business name or anything like that until we started to think about the opportunities that were ahead in this true activation of dormant goods. And it's funny, in 2015, we had all this beautiful food supplied to our volunteers by Coles. And so volunteers would work for 2 weeks on and off at their own rate and speed. And we wanted to feed them so that we could show them appreciation. And Coles supplied us with a bunch of food and lots of sausages and some great product. And at the end, we had all this leftover food. And of course, we knew OzHarvest rescue food. And what we realized when they came to rescue our food is that they rescue food and we rescue stuff. And there's this beautiful circular movement now where, as much as they don't want to see food waste ending up in landfill, we don't want to see dormant goods laying dormant in people's homes. We want to pull those out into the economy and bring them into second, third life. And if they're not usable, then where do we send them so that they actually do have a second or third life as a different product?
So it's a serious connection there, and it's a win-win.
Yeah.
Win-win-win. I don't think anyone loses in that.
No.
Yeah, as the world's biggest garage sale, the name, I think... We've had a chat before about going over to the US, and potentially there's another world's biggest garage sale in the US. Can you tell me about that little trip?
Yeah. So, Chris, this was funny because in 2015, after this event, my family and I actually travelled around Australia. I worked flexibly for my employer, the same employer that gave me a month off to do the garage sale. And during that trip, it really dawned on us the opportunity of scaling the world's biggest garage sale across Australia. So we started to do some research and we found this other garage sale or yard sale in America. And I thought, oh my gosh, I have to go there. I want to see this garage sale. How can they possibly raise? They were raising almost $600,000 in a single day. Now I thought, oh, it must be because it's America and they're so enormous. But when we started to actually look at who they were and how they were doing it, we learned that they were on an island, not even on the mainland of America, off Seattle, and they had 24,000 people in their community. So the metrics were puzzling. How can a 24,000 population community sell almost $600,000 in one day? And so we went over. I was going to Florida for work, and I said to my boss, hey, I want to stay on for an extra couple of weeks. How randomly coincidental is it that I've got to go to Florida in June, and this event is in June? So are you cool
Please
if I
let
just...
let me stay.
Let me stay. And he was so awesome. And you know, one of the things that enabled me is having a company that really looks very broadly at the whole human and not just trying to keep you in a pigeonhole for themselves. They always knew that our vision for the garage sale was bigger, and I think they probably knew more than I did at that time. So anyway, we still weren't a registered business, and we hung out in Florida for a couple of weeks. I took my family across, let them do all the Disney Worlds and stuff, and basically said to my kids, all right, you know that crazy garage sale thing we do every year? We're going to go to what is really the world's biggest garage sale, and we're going to learn from them. And they knew we were there to learn. We were really transparent. And I said to my two daughters, you can have your holiday in Florida, but when we get to Bainbridge Island, it's not a holiday. We're working. We're going to be 2 weeks volunteers. We're going to be awesome volunteers and really learn as much as we can. And so we learned as much as we could. And they were so lovely and transparent and really work in partnership with us, because what we saw is this beautiful machine operating. 4,500 cars coming through in a 6-day period, donating their dormant goods to a community of 1,400 volunteers who built it over a 10-day period to then in one day raise $579,000. It was magic, Chris, and it made me go, oh my gosh, Brisbane has millions of people. we could raise $500,000 in Brisbane. We could raise $1 million in Brisbane. We totally have to go all in on this. And I came back and met with the chief entrepreneur at the time, Mark Sowerby, and he said, Yaz, you've been running a business for 4 years. You just don't realize you've been running a business. If you can afford to feed your family for the next 12 to 18 months with no income, then why don't you quit your job and do this? And it was literally like this moment of disbelief, because it was like dangling this beautiful carrot. I wanted to quit my job and do this, but you know, I was the breadwinner. How can I possibly quit my job and not be able to earn an income? But as fortune had it, because we traveled around Australia and I was actually getting paid and working full time, we were prepared to travel around Australia and not earn an income. So we were going to kind of live off some of our savings to do this memorable life experience. So I just figured that the way the universe worked was that this was going to be the memorable life experience. And we were going to invest a year to a year and a half in going all in on this concept that we knew and believed had a positive impact for people, for planet, and profit for purpose. So for us, it was, if we can do good things in a month, imagine what we can do in a year. So it was no question. Mark Sowerby challenged me to quit my job. And even though I traveled around Australia working remotely for this brilliant company, who then let me spend a month in America learning about this concept, I came back and there was a lot of ugly crying to the CEO, but I quit my job within a week of being back in Brisbane.
And now you're full-time world's biggest garage sale. And since then, you've done some amazing things. You've gone through an accelerator program, which is normally for startups, I suppose, or software companies, etc., which is something a little bit outside the square for you. And you've also been involved in the CEO program. Can you talk about potentially getting immersed in the early stage startup scene and being based at the precinct, et cetera, and how you got into CEO?
Yeah, look, it's been interesting reflecting, especially on the last, say, 8 months. The first few months of running the business, we were really finding our feet. What sort of company are we? We met with all the big companies to try and decide, are we a not-for-profit? Are we a charity? Are we a business? And we really are a profit-for-purpose business. And so after we decided that, we really then went, okay, well, now how do we actually build a business model around it? And so we went and met with a lot of accelerators in the local Brisbane area. And River City Labs was interesting because they are very much known for tech. Mm. Like you have tech on your team, you're a tech company, come and build your product and we'll help you accelerate. And Christo, the manager of that tech accelerator, I was hanging out at the precinct, going to lots of events, really wanting to learn from people like Mark Sowerby, who was kind of transitioning out of the chief entrepreneur role when Steve Baxter came in. And it was around that time, and I met people like Wayne Gerard and a lot of amazing people. I think that's when we met Chris at an event over there, you know, Michael Reed from Cisco. And I started to meet all these humans that I was like, oh my God, these people are like my people. This is the tribe. And I almost lived at the precinct pretty much. I was there at any event I could get to, whenever I could get there. And it really dawned on me then that even though this was a tech accelerator, it felt like the right place for us. River City Labs, the energy, the people, the community. And it made no sense. Well, I remember being at boot camp, and so we were shortlisted to be one of the teams. And all these teams around me were so inspiring, building these amazing tech products with CTOs and people knowledgeable about tech. And here we were, this little hacker company, just building a world's biggest garage sale out of people's secondhand product. And so I remember Steve Baxter, it was hilarious. I'm sure he won't mind me telling the story. We had to just pop around to all the different tables, and there was a table about founders and a table about tech and a table about sales and business development. And we nail the sales, business development, partnership stuff. We're good at customer experience. We're really good humans. And so there were a lot of ticks that day. And then we had to sit on the tech table. And I'm sitting there in my shirt, the world's biggest garage sale brand. And I remember Steve, he's like, and I don't want to swear, but he was like, fork, I really love your brand. It's awesome. But how the hell are you a tech company? And I just looked at him like, Steve, we're not a tech company. That's why we're here. Yeah. We need to learn how to bring technology into our business to grow the brand that we've grown. Like, we do a lot of good stuff. We don't do tech very well. We kind of hack it together with Google Docs and Jira and Trello and whatever else we could get our hands on. But we felt that there was a piece of magic in this accelerator that would help us understand how to bring tech in to build our platform to then enable anyone anywhere in the world to hold their own world's biggest garage sale. That was the potential we wanted to tap into. So I'm really grateful. I don't know what conversations went on behind the scenes when they had to decide whether or not they would let this world...
The powers to be.
Yeah, the powers to be. I don't know that Steve would have put us in. You'd have to ask him. But I'm sure we looked like this really weird kind of company trying to come into a tech accelerator that didn't have any tech. But look, they took a punt on us, and I'm really grateful they did, because it meant they gave us an investment. It's public knowledge.
Yes.
$100,000 for 6% of our company. They took a punt on us. And you know what, Chris? I took that really seriously. I went straight into, you know, what are my strengths and skills? And I'm going to be a really great founder. I am a really great founder. I fit the mold when it comes to being a good human. I didn't know tech, and I really drew on people like Peter Lorre, Lou Jury, all the entrepreneurs, all the that brains trust, Steve himself, all the other amazing people in the ecosystem. I was like the biggest sponge. Pretty much you had to kick me out.
Which is all you have to do. You have to keep learning.
Yeah, I just went and learned as much as I could in that 6-month period.
Fabulous. And the CEO? Let's talk about that.
Well, CEO actually came to us through the ecosystem. So Monica Bradley, who's a super activator, she was talking. She's been an advisor really to us, and a great human connector to us right from the start. And she told me about CEO, which I learnt out from Julie Trell as well, who was one of the Telstra and investor in our company through the accelerator. And as soon as I heard about CEO, I was like, what is this? And look, I am not, I'm the mother of two daughters. And in our family, it's a bit different. Like, my husband's more the primary carer than me. So I'm not a front of the picket line, women's rights, activists, you know, give us everything we need woman. But I am absolutely a believer that females need to be activated and have a community around them to enable acceleration. And I feel like we're our own worst enemy. And I myself suffer from imposter syndrome at times. But what CEO made me feel is that this was a group, a tribe of women globally, who actually got in and got shit done. Go in and support one another. And what I loved, as soon as I found out that you could pay $1,100 and be an activator, which effectively funds a female founder to go and grow her venture, I didn't even think about it. Like, I didn't pay myself an income, but I still went, you know what, I'm going to find $1,100 of my own money to invest in, along with 500 other women here in Australia. It's the first time it's been done.
That's a huge number of people to be.
I wanted to be one of those women. I knew Julie Trell was an activator, Monica Bradley, Holly Ransom. Some amazing humans are activators. And I thought to myself, I had serious FOMO. There was no way I was not going to be a part of that. And fortunately, as an activator, you're actually also allowed to apply to be a venture. And so when they opened the venture applications, 150 companies applied. And the way they pick the top 15, who then go to a top 5, and it's in progress at the moment, it's at the top 15 stage, is the activators vote. So as an activator, I got to see 10 ventures sent to me in this beautiful platform, where I could read all about these amazing 10 companies led by women, run by women, doing incredible things. And I have to tell you, it was one of the hardest things I've ever had to do, to pick the top, what I thought was 5.
Picking a child.
Oh my God, how do I pick a favorite? And interestingly, it was a random thing, and the world's biggest garage sale application was in my top 10. And so I thought to myself, I did the total imposter thing. I was like, do I vote for my own company? And I actually emailed the CEO crew, and they said, you absolutely vote for your own company. If you had it land in your lap that you're one of your own companies to vote for, you absolutely vote for yourself.
I didn't know what to do.
And I have to admit, when I was reading through, I felt like we were definitely in what I would have picked the top 5 in the 10 that I had. So I did vote
looking
for our company.
And I looked
at it really... I did go outside of my own organisation and try not to have too much bias, but I felt so honoured to have our company line up alongside those other 10 ventures that I had to read. And let me tell you, we need to definitely do a bit more of this, because there's some amazing companies out there that just need, like, I think 1,100 women, so $500,000 gets invested into 5 ventures, and the voting actually starts in a week for the 15. It's 16, the 16 of us. And the 16 companies will now get looked at by the 500 female activators across Australia, and those 500 activators choose the top 5 companies.
Wow.
It's pretty cool. It's a great concept.
Hopefully the fruits of the networking, at least, if anything, if not the money, can basically assist your business in a positive way?
I actually think the money's one thing. So it's a loan. It's not an investment in your company. They give you, let's call it $100,000, but you don't know how much you get until you sit with the other four founders. If you are lucky enough to be a finalist, you sit together as five founders and decide how the $500,000 gets split up, which I think is incredible. I want to be a part of that experience. Not for the money, but for the network. And I actually think, while $100,000 would be nice, it is a loan, so you pay it back over 5 years, which is fantastic. But it really feels like trust money. I feel like it's an activator in itself to give you the belief and the network. And I think that I actually know that the network is far more valuable than that $100,000. $100,000 is almost just like a buffer.
Yep.
It gives you a buffer and a bit of time to get it going, and then that network is what truly supercharges your business.
Excellent. Well, fingers crossed that potentially get into the top five
and
be part of that 500,000.
Oh, I hope so. And if not, I'm an activator, so I'll still support the ventures that get through, and that's going to be really exciting.
And moving forward to World's Biggest Garage Sale, let's sit here in 3 years' time and talk about where you are. Where do you see yourself?
Oh, look, we see ourselves as almost like the TEDx of TED for garage sales. So, or the Parkrun of garage sales. So I've spoken to the CEO of Parkrun in the UK, and he was incredible, very inspirational man who's built an incredible movement. Community and movement. And I feel like we're the same thing. Volunteers come in to a community, and the benefit of what we do is we help them raise money. So for us, our business model going forward is to ensure that our platform and design solution supports any community being able to have a six-figure plus World's Biggest Garage Sale in their own communities, where we make a little bit of money by taking a percentage of license fee, which we try and keep as low as possible so that we can run our business profitably and continue to activate more garage sales, but more importantly, be able to get the community to come forward and get involved in a circular economy movement that's really activating people and planet and generating profits for their own community.
Fabulous. And Yaz, one final question. You're an entrepreneur, you've quit your job, you're running your own startup, and you're being recognised for your efforts and hopefully build something great in the next few years and beyond. What's some advice that you can give to maybe your younger self or even some aspiring entrepreneurs that are sitting there going, I see something here, but I actually don't know whether I should either quit my job or whether I should go for it?
Look, I often say there's no planet B, which is all about why we are in the circular economy, but I also say no plan B. And that's something that I've seen as a big theme from people who I look up to or admire from afar. Some I don't know, some I do know. And no plan B has really allowed me to focus fully on making this work. If I was trying to go back to my job and do that 40, 50 hours a week, plus try and grow this, there's no way I would be able to say that we're where we are now. Like, we've diverted millions of kilos of product from potential landfill. We've raised hundreds of thousands of dollars for the community. We've been able to survive as a startup, you know, bootstrapping our way to success. And we've won some incredible awards here in Brisbane with the Lord Mayor's Business Award. None of that would have happened if we didn't seek out mentors, listen to their advice, welcome mentor whiplash, which really hurts. One person telling you one thing, another telling you another, and you then having
it's
to make a decision.
It's quite common amongst startup founders. You get dragged both ways, and you're like, well,
at the
end of the day, it's up to you.
It's up to you. Yeah. So two of my most favourite mentors and advisors gave us very differing opinions about going into the River City Labs Accelerator. One said, do it, you're an idiot if you don't. One said, don't do it, you're an idiot if you do. Both of those people are still strong advisors and mentors for us right now. So I would say to founders, go and seek mentors, people that inspire you, but don't expect them to have the same opinion. Almost actively seek out people with differing opinions, because your real job as a founder and as someone that should go, and if you believe in your product enough, find people who believe in you so that they can help you believe in yourself when those moments of darkness or challenge come, because they will come. This is not all fairies and rainbows. It's absolutely hard work. So find your tribe. Your tribe will get you through. And look, we've had some really high moments along the last 9 months, and we've also had some really low moments. I lost my mum, and then my husband lost his dad 48 hours later, all while we're trying to build the latest World's Biggest Garage Sale in Brisbane. I can tell you right now wholeheartedly, all money aside, all business aside, that we were able to survive and thrive during that really difficult time, personally and professionally, because of the mentors, the advisors, the friends, get out there and don't be shy. If you're thinking something, go and sit at River City Labs, sit at Fishburners, sit everywhere you can to go and meet people out there doing it. Don't just talk.
Yep.
Go do.
Fabulous advice. Find your tribe.
Yeah, your tribe is so important. They'll help you no matter what, and ask. If you don't ask, you don't get.
Yes, thank you so much for coming in and sharing the world's biggest garage sale story. Congratulations on what you've achieved in the last 4 years, five years now, and looking forward the next 4 or 5 years. I'm looking forward to seeing this thing grow to be a global movement.
Thanks, Chris.
Cheers.